Good morning. Welcome to the Human Services, Finance and Policy Committee. I call this committee to order. We will begin with the, we have got a quorum present. We'll begin with the approval of the minutes for February 18, 2026. Representative Vanik, did you have a chance to read the minutes?
I did, Chair Noor. I'd like to move the minutes of February 18th.
Representative Vanik moves the approval of February 18, 2026 minutes. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? None. The motion prevails. The minutes for February 18, 2026 are now approved. Members, today we have got an overview briefing that we will go through. It's about DHS program integrity. We have Director Graham with us, and welcome again, early in the morning. Hopefully we'll give everybody coffee so that you can get going. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christy Graham, and I'm the Director of State Government Relations at the Department of Human Services. Thanks for having us back today to do sort of a part two continuation of some of the discussion that we started in yesterday's committee around implementation updates as they relate to program integrity. So today I was hoping, and yesterday we covered EIDBI and early intensive developmental behavioral intervention. Today we were hoping to do a little bit more of a deep dive for the community or for the committee and take maybe a little bit of a step back and talk about some of the actions that DHS is taking in partnership with the legislature around program integrity before jumping into the specific implementation updates. So, get started here. So I thought it'd be helpful just to start out with defining the term, sort of a term of art, program integrity. So this is really an umbrella term that's used to describe a program or a service and how it's structured in a way to potentially meet its intended outcome or purpose. So this is something when we talk about program integrity, it certainly includes fraud, which I think is what we hear a lot about these days, and that's rightly so. But it also includes other things like in the Medicaid space, having sound reimbursement requirements, data analytics and surveillance, provider and member education, making sure that we have appropriate enrollment and credentialing requirements in place for providers, looking at utilization management, understanding, is someone getting the service that they need based on what their diagnostic assessment says or their individual treatment plan says. And then, of course, detecting those improper payments, which could be unintentional. They could be errors, billing errors, oversights, and they could also potentially be fraudulent billing. So just wanted to give the committee that sort of backdrop that when we talk about program integrity, we're not just talking about fraud. We're talking about upstream efforts as well as the detection and enforcement when there's fraudulent activity. Another thing I think on this concept that would be helpful to note is fraud is really the intentional and criminal misuse of Medicaid funds. There's lots of definitions out there. CMS has a definition. The United States Health and Human Services has a definition. But generally speaking, that's what it means. So these are things like intentionally billing for services that weren't actually delivered or billing for more services than were delivered. And I accidentally moved to the next slide. But just to go back 1 second, waste and abuse are the unintentional and non-criminal misuse of Medicaid funds. So these are things like accidental billing for maybe a more expensive service or unknowingly billing for services that Medicaid didn't deem necessary. All right, so why is program integrity particularly important for Medicaid? Medicaid is really a lifeline for so many of our community members across Minnesota. And we know that ultimately preventing fraud, detecting it, making sure that we stop it when we encounter it, is going to help the people who rely on these supports and services that are covered under Medicaid. So Medicaid, as I mentioned, is a lifeline in Minnesota. It's the largest single source of health insurance in Minnesota, serving over 1 million recipients. And it contributes really profoundly to our state's healthcare sector, supporting public health infrastructure, hospitals, mental health, home care, community clinics, nursing facilities, and more. In particular, it's a really important resource for Greater Minnesota, and it's really helping to reduce the number of uninsured Minnesotans so that there's a less cost of uncompensated care across the state, particularly for clinics and hospitals. Under Medicaid, we're covering about 40% of all of Minnesota's children. That statistic might be slightly outdated, but it's right around there. So it's almost 600,000 children in the state of Minnesota are covered by Medicaid. And also, there's about 3 out of 10 births in the state are covered by Medicaid. And these are just important statistics to keep in mind when we think about if there are threats to Medicaid, if program integrity is compromised in Medicaid, the impacts will be felt by these communities. In addition to children and birthing people, Minnesota also serves and spends a large proportion of its funding on seniors and people with disabilities. So about 60% of our medical assistance funds are spent on people with disabilities or people who are over 65. So it's a significant spend, and it's a really important one because I think we all hold that value of making sure that people can live, in their homes, in their communities, and be supported in the end of life as well. Medicaid also pays for more mental health services than in Minnesota than any other payer. So we reimburse about 20% of all mental health treatment in the state. And we also pay about half of all substance use disorder services in the state. Medicaid covers about half of long-term care costs in Minnesota. So a lot of folks mistake this with Medicare, but Medicare actually doesn't pay for nursing facilities. It's Medicaid that does. So this is a really critical service for our older adult populations as well. And as I mentioned earlier, this is particularly important for Greater Minnesota, where there's medical assistance covers a greater proportion of Medicaid covers a significant proportion of people in Greater Minnesota. There's maps that we've got online where you can see by region the coverage and the percentage of people that are on Medicaid in each region, and those are really helpful to take a look at if members haven't seen those yet. All right, so this slide is just a really quick graphic. It's not comprehensive, but I wanted to share with the committee some of the actions that DHS is taking to make sure that we can protect Medicaid for all of your constituents and the people that our programs serve. So really quickly, some of the actions that DHS and the governor have been taking. I mentioned yesterday, last April, we increased the risk levels for EIDBI as well as housing stabilization services. I think that was effective in May. Of course, at the end of May, early June, depending on which bill you're looking at, legislation passed, which was a really important opportunity for collaboration with the legislature. And there were a lot of important measures in there to increase program integrity and make sure we had proper controls in all of our programs. Moving forward a little bit to the fall time, Governor Walz issued his executive order, so Executive Order 2510, in mid-September, and that order was really focused on preventing waste and abuse in state programs, making sure that, like the legislature, the executive branch was stepping up to make sure that this was a top priority for all of our enterprise. And there were specific actions that DHS was required to complete as a part of that executive order. Also, soon thereafter in October, we worked on disenrolling inactive providers. So about 100,000 individual providers and 761 agencies were terminated. And those are agencies that weren't billing and I think over more than a year. And so that was important just to make sure that we were keeping our books up to date so that if we did have bad actors potentially where we were putting a stop payment and they had maybe other entities that were enrolled, that we were able to better control that potential negative outcome. So that's work that we'll continue to do and work with the legislature on to make sure that we're not keeping providers enrolled if they're not actually using our Medicaid programs. In October, we designated 9 additional Medicaid services as high risk. I think many of you have heard about those. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go into the presentation. And then early this year, we implemented prepayment review, which has been a significant topic of discussion, but a really important tool, not the end-all tool, but an important tool to make sure that we're on the front end addressing improper payments and helping to support providers get into compliance and prevent bad actors from exploiting the system. And then we've had a few other moratoriums and an HCBS licensing moratorium that was implemented. That was an authority that Chair Noor and Chair Schumacher granted the department last session, and we took them up on that and issued that home and community-based services licensing moratorium. We also have a provider enrollment moratorium, a six-month provider enrollment moratorium for those 14 high-risk programs. And a few other actions have been taken over the course of the past couple of years, but I wanted to just highlight there's been a lot of work on the executive level in collaboration with the legislature in this space. So when we think about program integrity at DHS, we're in the midst of an era where there are more sophisticated fraud schemes occurring, and we have to be prepared, we have to be methodical, we have to be planful. So the way we're approaching this work is really kind of based on these four pillars right now. So we're thinking about making sure that we're transparent. We've got transparency for the legislature, for the community. We're able to share information, to work in collaboration across the community and across the state to address fraud and program integrity. We really are trying to focus on prevention. I'm going to go into more depth on these, so we'll talk more about these in a bit. But obviously, we need to be making sure that our systems are detecting fraud and we have the tools in place to do that. And then enforcement, which is in part a DHS responsibility as the administrative body that, you know, can do payment withholds for providers when there's potentially credible allegations of fraud. But it's also a partnership with federal and state law enforcement. All right, so thinking about transparency, one of the things that I mentioned earlier is that Medicaid is something that's, Medicaid oversight is a shared responsibility. The human services system isn't just run by DHS. The federal government has a say, the state government has a say. Obviously, DHS is doing a lot of the work as well, but we're doing that in partnership with counties, with tribal nations, with others in community, providers, of course. Many, many community providers are enrolled to provide Medicaid services. And we need to make sure that we're doing this work in collaboration and not in isolation. So we're really making an effort to improve our transparency in our programs. We're taking steps to be more proactive and transparent, especially and particularly if we won't compromise investigative work or reveal any kind of private data. So recently we've taken steps to build transparency. So things like making sure that if there is a payment withhold and the media or the legislature wants to know about it, if there is an opportunity for us to share that and it doesn't compromise the investigation, we have a process in place to do that. And I just wanted to note also that you know, I think it goes without saying, but we strive for as much transparency as possible. But there are times when we are trying to build a case, we're working with law enforcement who are trying to build a case, and they might tell us, no, DHS, please do not share that information because that would compromise our investigation and our potential ability to prosecute, you know, a bad actor. We also have situations which are frustrating probably to the legislature as well as to DHS sometimes that but it's really important to uphold those data privacy provisions in state law. So there's times when you might hear about, you know, an individual and maybe they're losing a service or they're having a particular experience with the system, and we can't always share the full picture because we have data privacy protections in place for good reason. But just wanted to highlight that there are some limitations on what we can share in terms of transparency. So 2025 session, as I mentioned, we got the authority to acknowledge that payment withholds or payment suspensions were in place when it doesn't compromise or impact an investigation. So that's discretion that was given to the commissioner. That's in Chapter 13 of, I believe, House File 2. So that was an important provision that the legislature has been asking for a while. We also have a DHS licensing lookup list. So for members who don't know about that, it's a really helpful tool. I use it personally all the time to understand when I get constituent requests. Is this a DHS provider? Is it an MDH provider? And I look through to see, are there sanctions? Are there, is there a pattern of licensing violations, for example? That can be helpful information when I get requests or when you get requests from constituents or just to understand, a new provider in your community and what might be going on with them. We also have a newly published dashboard, and I don't have the link, I don't think, in the slides, but I'm happy to share that with the committee if I haven't shared it with you all already. But we've got a dashboard. We're updating it continually, where we're really trying to keep more open communication about actions that DHS is taking, how many open cases we have, how many open cases the Attorney General's office might have, administrative actions, and a lot of important data that we think will be helpful to lawmakers as well as the community at large. So having a robust fraud prevention network really helps to stop fraud before it occurs. Since joining DHS about a year ago, a little bit less than a year ago, maybe last March, Inspector General Clark has been on a mission to refocus and double down on prevention efforts. Because by the time, fraudulent cases get to his office and the Office of Inspector General at DHS, or they even get to the Attorney General or the U.S. Attorney's Office, certainly we're going to take an aggressive stance and address when there needs to be an administrative sanction or some kind of criminal case going on. But we would rather prevent those from happening and prevent the money from flowing out the door in the first place. Prevention efforts involve every step of the Medicaid funding process. So obviously the legislature plays a role in this in setting up careful criteria for who can serve as a provider and making sure that we've got appropriate training and supports for providers in place. And we've seen a real renewed effort by the legislature, particularly last session in that. So we're looking forward to doing more of that work with you. And I would also say that historically Medicaid programs, and this is sort of a national trend, focused on, recovering misspent funds after the fact and sort of paying and chasing models is what they're referred to. But we're really trying to refocus more heavily on prevention and early detection. So that's something that we're doing in Minnesota and that we're seeing across the nation. So a few things in terms of prevention that DHS has done over the past year. So we've identified those 14 Medicaid service provider types as high risk, 13 or 14 depending on how you count. Because PCA and CFSS are effectively almost the same service. These were identified as high risk because they had potential programmatic vulnerabilities. There might be evidence of increased fraudulent activity that we're detecting through our current data analytics tools. There could be some claims anomalies or outliers that we're seeing. It's not a judgment call on the service itself or the people that are using the service. It's really us looking at what is the structure of the service? What are we seeing as outcomes? And is there a potential need for us to do more enhanced oversight of these services? And as I mentioned yesterday, the risk designations are federally defined, but it is up to the Medicaid agency to be monitoring and tracking what needs to be in certain categories by and large. So the list, you probably have seen it, but for the 14 high-risk services, those include adult companion services, adult day services, ARMS, which is Adult Rehabilitative Mental Health Services, Assertive Community Treatment, EIDBI, Night Supervision. So there's a whole grouping of those. I'm happy to share those with the committee if you haven't seen them yet. They're also on our dashboard. So feel free to get more familiar with those. And we'll probably be focusing a lot on making sure that we've got the appropriate measures in place to prevent fraud in those programs. Also of note, the 2025 legislature gave DHS more tools to make sure that we can keep out bad actors and potentially look at provider applications earlier on. And so there were things that were passed last session, for example, pre-enrollment risk assessments for recuperative care and other measures that are really helpful for us to take that look earlier on. We're also trying to step up our work when it comes to provider support, provider technical assistance, education. So we are, as an agency, holding We always have provider Medicaid roundtables, but we're holding additional roundtables. We're issuing a lot more guidance. We have a new kind of advisory ad hoc group that we're working with of providers that's telling us, you know, when you sent out that communication, it really didn't make sense to us, or maybe you should have given us a heads up as a provider association. We can help you communicate with our providers. We can be a tool for you, too, to help educate our provider groups. So we're really trying to focus in there. I believe, are in the process, or we may have already hired a public funds coordinator to better monitor payments to grantees and to track our public funds and making sure they're being used appropriately in the agency. All right, so moving to detection, this is obviously a key part of our work here at DHS. As I mentioned earlier, we cover over a million Minnesotans, and we have over 40,000 community providers in the state. So this is a huge amount of work and monitoring that the agency needs to do in partnership with our federal and state law enforcement partners. So we work to detect fraud and waste and make sure that we're identifying that so it's not undermining the supports that are needed across the state. We have a zero tolerance approach to fraud. And we're really, as I mentioned, trying to detect it early so that we can keep the fraudulent actors out of our system altogether. So a few things to mention in terms of detection and some of the efforts that are underway at the department. So we are utilizing new data analytics tools to uncover fraud. And these will, you know, we've already used them to initially flag some issues that we've seen across programs in the 14 high-risk programs. I believe we got some funding for these for this work last session. We fell a little bit short with some of the AI or artificial intelligence funding that we had requested through the governor's budget recommendations last year, but we hope to be back and talking with the legislature more about ongoing needs there. Certainly data analytics isn't the only tool, and we need to be very careful that we balance everything that we're doing when it comes to data analytics with human review and making sure there are checkpoints there to guard against, you know, potential bias in the system, or, you know, there's sometimes we have to train systems to work for our to be aligned with our rules and our regulations at the state and federal level in our Medicaid program. So it's definitely a partnership, but data analytics is a tool that we need to be using more of in the state of Minnesota to be more efficient with our program integrity efforts. We've also expanded unannounced on-site visits to detect fraud and uncover where there's maybe potential licensing violations. So we're doing this with EIDBI providers, and we also have efforts underway related to our revalidations that are required for the 14 high-risk providers. Won't spend much time on enforcement, but I did just want to make sure, you know, we kept it on here, but obviously holding providers accountable is a really important part of this work. It's at the tail end of the spectrum of tools that we use when it comes to program integrity, but certainly important to be, when we identify a credible allegation of fraud, to be instituting a payment withhold and to be referring those cases to the MFUCU, or the Minnesota Fraud Control Unit, at the Attorney General's office, as well as the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI and our other federal partners. In that, I think it's important to note that we have partnered with county leaders to facilitate transitions, particularly when there's payment withholds in residential settings. So the legislature has probably heard concerns, and you probably, you know, have concerns of your own about how this is playing out. When we do identify a credible allegation of fraud, what does that mean for people in the system? And that is a really important thing that we need to balance. What we found at the department with some of the recent waves of fraud in a few of our programs is that we've gotten reports from counties, from individuals themselves, from, you know, case managers, from vulnerable adult reports, for example, reporting neglect or abuse. So we're getting a lot of reports that individuals in these settings weren't actually getting the services that they needed. Of course, in a residential setting, people also have housing. So when you make when you do a payment withhold in those settings, certainly it will impact their housing, and we need to make sure that we're doing a better job as a system to support people in their transitions. So Commissioner Gandhi has set up a process whereby she's working with county leaders to make sure that she has their assurances that we can share some data with our case managers ahead of payment withholds, and that they are understanding that we need to make sure people aren't losing access to services or housing to the best of our ability. We've heard that counties are often struggling with capacity in this area. That is a longstanding problem in the human services system that we should talk about more this session when the time is right, in terms of waiver case management and how that's reimbursed and current caseloads. But I think one thing that DHS is really trying to do to respond to that issue is to step up with some of our own staff at the department and our complex transitions team. We have a referral form that's being used now for people that, you know, might be in a setting that's impacted by, for example, a payment withhold, and where they need some additional support to transition. It's also the case, as the legislature has rightly pointed out, that not all payment withholds or payment, you know, delays are for waiver programs. So not everyone has a case manager at the county. So if you're on PCA and you're not on a waiver, you don't have a case manager. We tried to build that in a little bit more to Community First Services and Supports, the new PCA program, where people have someone that's similar to a case manager, but that is a gap. And so for individuals who aren't on waivers, we need to make sure that they have an option to reach out to the department. We can support them as much as possible with transitions. I will say one of the challenges here is that affordable housing in general is an issue. Is we don't have enough of it, and we need more of it, particularly for people with disabilities in these situations. So we are working actively at the department with Minnesota Housing, with the Office of with the Implementation Office, to be better advocates for housing across the board. Certainly we have a role in it, but the system as a whole does as well. So maybe I'll jump right into some of the updates. Transition to what passed last session and what we're doing in terms of implementing the provisions that were passed. This isn't a comprehensive and full update because there was a lot of language that was passed in three different bills. I think the two bills in special session in particular, so House File 2 and House File 3, as well as a policy bill that was maybe one of the only bills passed in regular session, omnibus bills passed in regular session, so props to Chair Schumacher and Chair Noor for getting that across the finish line in regular session. But wanted to start with a few updates in our behavioral health program and what was moved forward last session, what passed, and where we're at with those items. So the midpoint rule is something that, a provision that the governor brought forward last session. This is a rule that basically, it's federal guidance, I think it's in federal law, that says when you're billing a time-based code, more than half of the time can be spent performing the service to be eligible for reimbursement. And importantly, what we're trying to clarify in state law with the change last session is that the remainder of that time can't be billed for another, the same service. So what we were seeing in the SUD space in particular was some double billing, where providers were kind of taking advantage of a slight loophole there. We would argue it was a federal law, but we nevertheless clarified it in state law. We issued guidance. We want to make sure that providers are aware that they couldn't do that. One of the areas that that was occurring was when we were seeing kickbacks occur. So providers were billing more to be able to pay for housing, which is not allowed to be paid using Medicaid funds. So this was sort of a complex scheme that had to be unraveled, and this midpoint rule clarification was one part of that last session. So this is in effect now. This is, as I mentioned, it's federal law, but we've updated our provider manual. We've notified providers through e-memos. We've let them know, hey, you cannot do this. As early as last July. We've presented on this topic to make sure there's clarity there. We've had, we have open monthly meetings with the SUD, Substance Use Disorder Provider Community. We've talked about it there, taken questions there, and we've done some trainings for providers. So we're hoping that we've got that implemented well and that won't be a problem ongoing. In addition, a lot of language passed around recovery residences. So recovery residences used to be called sober homes. We moved in state law to the term recovery residences, which I believe is the sort of the more modernized term that SAMHSA uses and other entities use to talk about settings that are, these aren't providing typically Medicaid services, but they're providing supportive housing services to people in recovery, oftentimes in early recovery. And shout out to Representative Gilman, Representative Frederick for really advocating for a lot of these reforms. Last session in particular, we were really pleased with that collaboration. This was something that the governor brought forward and that you all helped to make it better. So we definitely appreciated that work together. And this work has started, the conversations around recovery residences and sober homes started quite a while ago. So it took a while to get here. It was a lot of effort. But the 2023 legislature did enact some requirements for recovery residences in Chapter 254B, but they didn't really have any enforcement with them. They were sort of just like, These are the best practices and rights that people should have when they're in sober homes. But there wasn't really an oversight entity to say, okay, sober home, you're not doing this, and you need to if you want to be, you know, for example, certified or on a list of sober homes that people can choose from and know that they're providing high quality services. So this proposal, effectively, to ensure that recovery residences are following best practice, it establishes it's a voluntary certification, which aligns with the standards identified in they're in statute now, and they're by and large the standards that are endorsed by the National Association of Recovery Residences, or NAR. These are also endorsed largely by SAMHSA. So these are things like making sure that there's appropriate documentation occurring, making sure that people have rights to, you know, access their belongings if they leave or if they need to leave, making sure that there's appropriate transitions in place. So there's a whole host of requirements now that we worked on last session with the legislature. As part of the, and those are effective, I believe, I think the certification starts January 1, 2027. So we've got a little bit more of work to do on this, but we are working with recovery residences to make sure that we've got those ready to go when they're effective. Related to this, what was known as freestanding room and board is going to be phased out. That was passed last session. So that will be phased out effective July 1st, 2027. And instead of using freestanding room and board, which is effectively housing funding through the Behavioral Health Fund, the legislature has allowed level two recovery residences to be able to, if they meet the eligibility criteria and if the person meets the eligibility criteria, to get housing support payments and to do that through Minnesota or through the state. So right now, typically counties manage housing support, but what we were encountering in the recovery space in particular, as well as in some other spaces right now, was counties were saying that they didn't have capacity to issue more housing support contracts. But that is a really important service because, as we talked about yesterday, and we'll probably talk about a lot this session, Medicaid doesn't pay for housing. It cannot pay for housing. So where we have funding streams in Minnesota that can help support people with their housing that need it, it's important to tap into those resources. Just a little bit about freestanding room and board. Freestanding room and board was established, I don't know, maybe a decade ago or so, and it was really to as a result of issues around housing in greater Minnesota, where there was a reported lack of residential treatment programs, and so instead they were standing up outpatient SED treatment programs with this additional freestanding room and board, so people would be able to stay there. But there are, we've noticed some significant gaps in the oversight of freestanding room and board that we needed to close that loop on and make sure that we've got more program integrity around those housing options for people. So that work has been ongoing. We've been developing standards. We've got a web page stood up. We're working on an RFP to get a vendor to create an online portal for this. And then also related to this topic, there's a work group that I believe has begun. And that's something that was a part of, I think, the compromise that we worked on with Representative Gilman and Frederick last session. So working with the sober home or the recovery residence community to understand what additional changes need to be made, how the certification is going, you know, are there certain issues that we need to adjust going forward? All right, also last session, we had some changes related to recovery community organizations and making sure that they've got compliance training. This sometimes was referred to as Steps for Success. So in the PCA program, there has been a longstanding compliance training called Steps for Success. PCA is oftentimes a program that we look to because it's an unlicensed service that did struggle with some program integrity issues back in the day. And so there was a lot more regulations and parameters put in place to make sure that that wasn't happening anymore. And so Steps for Success was one of those prevention measures that was put in place just to make sure that providers really understand what the service is, what the service requirements are. This is a training that we provide typically in collaboration with our partners at Department of Labor, as well as the Attorney General's Office, to really educate providers on what is fraud, what is appropriate billing. So we're trying to duplicate that model and other services, and then recovery community organizations is one of those services. Just as a reminder, if folks don't know, recovery community organizations provide peer-based support, advocacy, education to people to help them stay sober and remain in recovery. And these are the entities that are recognized as a state to be eligible vendors of peer recovery services. Just an MA service, it's a non-clinical service, but a really important service for people to be able to have that kind of support as they move through their recovery journeys. But we do need to make sure, given that it's not licensed and it's a non-clinical service, that we've got much more training and regulations in place. So there's a lot of work that's been done in this space over the years. And last session, the compliance training was one of the pieces that was passed by the legislature. So we're working on developing that compliance training for the owners and managers of recovery community organizations. We work closely with MARCO, which is the statewide entity that helps to educate and support recovery community organizations. And we've got to make sure that we've got that training available this summer. And we believe we're on track to meet that implementation deadline. I think the last thing that I wanted to mention in the behavioral health space were changes related to substance use disorder services. So those passed last year in Chapter 9. And these were governor recommendations that were picked up by the legislature. So thank you for working with us on this provision. Currently, SUD treatment services were billed in one-hour increments under either individual counseling or group counseling. And those codes don't differentiate the different array of subservices that could be delivered under those codes. So to kind of align with our best standards that are being issued by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, create more transparency, and really to create more customized services for people so that we can make sure that they're getting the services that they need according to their individual treatment needs. Last year's bill disaggregated those two codes into six distinct new codes that are, instead of hour units, 15-minute units. So this allows for more customization and person-centered care and obviously more transparency. We can see better what's going on, what services are being delivered, how are they tied to outcomes. As a part of our 1115 demonstration SUD waiver, we do have to show outcomes and report on those to the federal government. So this is part of that effort. So this is effective, I think, in the upcoming July of 2026, so this summer. So we've got a state plan amendment that's been drafted, and it will be posted for public comment this week, I'm told. So it may have been posted. I haven't seen it yet, but others may have. So keep a watch out for that. If your constituents are interested in providing public comment, we've got 30 days of public comment, and then we would hope to get this SPA submitted to CMS in March or April, and remain on track with that July 1 implementation date. All right, so moving to kind of the broader bucket of fraud prevention, detection, and enforcement implementation and provisions that passed last session. So one of the widely discussed provisions that passed last session was the prohibition on illegal remunerations. This is sometimes called the kickbacks or anti-kickback statute. And we had a lot of collaboration with Chair Schumacher, with Megan, with the Judiciary Committee here in the House in particular. Ben was really helpful. DHS brought this forward, but of course we're not experts in the criminal code, so it was really a team effort to get this language ready. So this provision passed into law. There were changes in the criminal code in Chapter 609 that effectively say if you're a human services provider, you cannot intentionally offer money or offer some kind of benefit, maybe it's a housing benefit, in order to get someone to use your service. That's a very simplified way of saying it, but you can look at those specific requirements in law and get a better sense of exactly what the requirements are. But this is something that the Attorney General's office was having some difficulty prosecuting because we didn't have that in state criminal code. So there were federal requirements already, but we really wanted to make sure we had more tools for our law enforcement partners to be able to prosecute those cases when the fact patterns maybe didn't line up with other crimes, like theft, for example, that they might have used to substantiate their cases previously. This language also allows DHS to impose sanctions on individuals or entities that do kickbacks. So that's important to know, too, that it says specifically in this language that DHS can effectively institute a payment withhold or some kind of other sanction. So this has been fully implemented as of this past August, and it's mirrored in federal law by and large, so there wasn't a whole lot of implementation effort here, but certainly communication with the community on it. I mentioned earlier we got authority to share data last session, including claims data. Actually, this is a different provision that I mentioned with. This is about sharing data across the enterprise and across with other federal partners and state partners to investigate suspected fraud. So here in Minnesota, we have a lot of prescriptive laws around how we can share data, which is great. And I think we all appreciate that. So getting this language to specifically allow DHS to be able to work more collaboratively across the state with, you know, the Department of Education, Department of Health, the Office of Legislative Auditor, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is really key. And we've actually used this authority already to work on some of the fraud issues or suspected fraud that we've been working on. The one that I mentioned earlier is our authority to disclose payment withholds as long as it doesn't compromise an investigation. That's something that was has been long in the works and long sought after by the legislature. So thank you to all of you for supporting that. We had some language around statute of limitations on surety bonds and improving the department's ability to collect on surety bonds. Where we were told that they were timing out and we couldn't collect on them when there were instances of a provider, you know, going out of business and having fraudulent activity. So that was effective July 1st this past summer. And then increasing licensing fees is not explicitly, you know, addressing fraud, but a regulatory tool that was advocated largely by Chair Noor and included in the Human Services Bill. This is effective January 1, 2026. So providers will see increased fees on their next renewals. All right, and then in the licensing vein, we talked a lot about EADBI yesterday, so I don't think we need to rehash all of that, but we did last session get the authority to deny licensure applications or temporarily suspend a license for providers that are subject to a pending administrative, civil, or criminal investigation. So this was just a way to tighten up more of, you know, who's coming into our provider community. If we know that there are active investigations or issues in other spaces, we want to make sure that those play out before we're allowing them to become a Medicaid provider. So DHS has implemented this change. We've utilized this authority to issue temporary immediate suspensions as well as application denials for home and community-based services. So that was an important measure that sounds like not much, but it's being used and it's really helpful. Also, last session I mentioned the home and community-based services discretionary temporary licensing moratorium. So DHS provided notification to the legislature as well as to providers that we were going to implement this licensing moratorium. And I believe we have some reporting requirements and it's time limited. So we have to come back to the legislature and let you guys know how it's going. Do we need to extend the licensing moratorium? But this is an important effort to make sure that particularly with services where we see an oversaturation of providers and then challenges in overseeing and monitoring those providers, that we've got some stopgaps in place there to make sure that we're getting, people are getting the services that they need, but where we have maybe more providers than necessary, that we're slowing down those applications so we can catch up and make sure people are complying with the requirements. Important to note for this, there is an exception process in place. So lead agencies and tribes, if they're encountering someone who is like getting a service that is really a unique service that maybe only one provider type offers, or in greater Minnesota, there's not as many provider types, for example, there is a process by which lead agencies can reach out to the department and apply for an exception to make sure that people've got access to the appropriate services. I mentioned yesterday, but there is the EIDBI enrollment moratorium. This was approved by CMS. That was part of the EIDBI measures that passed last session, and approved by CMS effective November 1st, 2025 through April 30th of 2026. So we will likely be reassessing if we need to continue that, and working with the legislature and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services if we need to extend that. So those are the updates that I had to share with the committee today, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you so much. I know many of my colleagues have questions, and thank you for the overview. We'll start with Representative Ganda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of you know that in my other life, I'm a provider. I happen to be a Medicaid provider as an optometrist. And to my knowledge, I've never participated in fraud, waste, or abuse, so I'm kind of thankful for that.
We are too.
You know, in the moment that we are, I feel like we've put you and your agency in a bit of a catch-22. And why I say that is we're demanding that you identify fraud, you stop fraud. And by how do you identify fraud, you're going to look at claims a little more closely. In looking at claims a little more closely, there will be potentially a little time lag between when the claims are submitted and when those claims are paid, and that's created a problem. Another byproduct of shutting down fraud is that some fraudsters actually do provide legitimate service, right? So somebody's receiving the benefit of that service, you shut them down, and now you have individuals who were receiving good care no longer able to get the care from that provider. And so we have a need then to identify other providers for them so there's no lapse in service for them. When I looked back and I thought, good grief, why did you not tell these providers that there would be this additional two-week lag in payment? So I went to your website, I hit the various links, and the first memo that I saw coming out appeared to be October, November, which was pretty explicit, although it was revised in January of 26, I noticed that. But it was pretty explicit that there would be this additional step that could create a couple-week lag in payment within the 30-day statutory requirement of clean claims being processed. And so, but what occurred to me, and by all means you can respond to all of this, but it's going to come down to really good communication. Mm-hmm. And so as a provider, I can tell you I'm so busy day-to-day taking care of patients one after another, I don't always have time to think of what is my provider status, what is my repayment status, what is my, you know, billing turnaround time and all of that. I'm so busy locked on to just taking care of patients one after another that I'm not paying attention to memos and bulletins and whatnot that you all send. Yeah. So it's going to seem to me that we're going to have to overkill all of this communication. And you're kind of already doing it to the counties to find alternate providers, and even maybe setting up regional providers if someone can't do it inside of that county. Whatever y'all can do to communicate more and a little earlier, I know you've done it. I saw the series of memos. The information was there. Folks maybe didn't access that timely. So whatever we can do to really step up that communication, it seems like that's the common theme here, that we can, as we roll this out, and maybe minimize that catch-22 that we have you in. We demand that you do it, and then when you do it, the little bit of fallout from it that's not too good, well, then we burn you for that too. So somewhere in there, we have to make this happen with as little of that unintended consequence as we can. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for explaining the whole prepayment review process when it was unveiled.
Mr. Chair,
Director Graham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I also thank you. Really appreciate that perspective. because it is challenging when we do have bad actors, and it's a few, right? It's not, most providers are good providers, and they're providing really important services, so it's challenging to even talk about it because we don't want to, you know, cast shade over those good providers, which is, you know, compromise most of the Medicaid system. I would say with communication, I completely agree. We have taken accountability, I think, for having some missteps in communication. We could have done better and how we communicated. We have a new someone who's doing some work around communication. We're completely revamping our provider communication. You know, every crisis is a good opportunity to make improvements long term. So we're changing the way that we do all of our provider communications. We've instituted more provider roundtables. We've heard so far that that's appreciated by the provider community. We know we can't just send something in writing. I don't have time to read my emails either. So I can imagine that a provider who's seeing patients all day isn't going to be able, particularly smaller providers that don't have that robust infrastructure administrative-wise. So we need to do more. We need to, you know, do videos, have different modes of communication, and do multiple communication and more of it, even if it's repeating the same thing. So I just want to acknowledge that your point is well taken, and we are currently working to reform the way we do provider communications altogether.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Rump. Appreciate your work on this. I think we're, you know, we're going in the right direction in a lot of ways. You know, fraud in my constituents, I mean, it's all about where we're going next, and they're livid about it. They're livid because they're about ready to pay their taxes, and they see what happened. And so we have this relationship that we built. You're our only relationship in trying to make sure that we do the right thing for the people. And so you're that relationship. The relationship is built on trust. We trust what you give us for information. And maybe we didn't do a very good job of verifying that information to know for sure. So I want to take I have a couple questions that I like to ask that really just talk about verification for us, for the people watching, to know for sure, because maybe we didn't do a good enough job in the front side. And so when it comes to fraud, I'd just like to know what the department and leaders in the department, our resources, knew about the fraud, and when did we know it was starting to occur?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, agree with your sentiment. Fraud, when it's occurring, it erodes the public trust, and that is something that we need to reestablish and to rebuild. DHS has we're required by federal law to have an inspector general. Within that inspector general unit, there's multiple different program areas. So licensing and program integrity office are a couple of those areas. There's some others, background studies and things like that. And those areas are constantly looking at, taking in tips, looking at claims, and identifying potential fraudulent behaviors. So over the years, there's been a lot of investigations that are listed on that public dashboard that I mentioned, that we've actually been the entity that's identified the fraud and referred that to law enforcement. So certainly we've known about the fraud, we've made referrals. In some cases, we haven't been able to communicate about some of those actions right away, because what I mentioned is we were precluded in law from doing that, but we've got that authority now, and I agree, more transparency the better.
Thank you, Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just regarding the size of it, I mean, that's the part that I guess we all expect there might be some level that we just can't catch, but the overall size of fraud is what really is catching people off guard. The size of fraud in Minnesota is going to account for about $3,000 per taxpayer when they pay their taxes in April. Give me an idea where the DHS was at with regard to understanding the size of fraud.
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm assuming that you're talking about potential fraudulent spending. There's been a lot of numbers thrown out that we cannot confirm the veracity of. So there's been a $9 million number, there's been a $10 million number, there's been, or billion, sorry, I'm using millions instead of billions, $20 billion, which is the entirety of the Medicaid program. So people can throw out numbers if they want, but it doesn't make them true. And the reality is fraud is, until you actually prosecute and identify what the fraud was, it's very challenging to give you a number. And I understand that's frustrating, but that is the case. The Government Accountability Office has, I think, issued similar sentiments that there isn't an actual measure for fraud in place, that we have improper payments that we can look at, but that's not exactly fraud. So I think certainly we are tracking when we see an anomaly, like, you know, there's this huge spike of spending in peer recovery services, for example, and letting legislators know. I've received recent emails, for example, from legislators about this provider is upset that they got a notice, and it's like, well, we've seen an anomaly here. So we are tracking that, and we're doing more of that with the resources we got last session. But I will say that we haven't been doing enough of that proactive monitoring. We haven't had those resources. Largely, we've been doing a lot of tip-based complaints. So we are transitioning as an agency to identify that spending much earlier.
Thank you. Thank you, Director, Mr. Chair. So with regard to frauding, knowing where it came from, with regard to whistleblowers, how long ago did DHS have whistleblowers, and how big a thing is it? We've heard people come out now and really expose what turned out to be that level of fraud. So when did the DHS know about whistleblowers? And can you just give me just a little background? This is trust and verify time. We want to be able to trust you when we go to that next step with you, and you're going to ask us for help, and we need to help certain people, but we need to know. And so with regard to whistleblowers, two things. When did you know it, and what did you know, and has anybody been fired?
Representative Muff, I don't know if that is the right question for Director Graham. I think we will get the commissioner to come and testify on some of these issues in front of us. We'd like to give them the opportunity to come and talk about all the issues that you just raised. So appreciate you raising those questions, but I think we'll wait for the commissioner, temporary commissioner, to come and present.
That's fine. Thank you, Director. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Kier.
Thank you, Chair. Kind of to piggyback off of what Representative Gander was saying about educating our providers, I get nervous when I start to hear, especially in some of these really small communities, that like sending an email or just having something that you have to dig through on your website is hard. I like the idea of roundtables. What I hear from other agencies is when we do roundtables, there ends up being huge gaps of counties that are completely missed. And that's a problem because it tends to be communities like on my side of the state, on our side of the state, because when we only have a couple providers, they're busy doing the work. And I have a hard time telling people, well, you didn't do what you were supposed to, when we actually didn't do a really great job at meeting them where they are in the education lane. And so when you talk about roundtables, I'm glad to hear that you're stepping up the game a little bit on this education of providers. One, I would like to know how they're going to be invited. And if you start to have a mechanism that you see that there's certain areas, regions, or counties that are not participating, how then are you going to take some personal steps to reach out to them and not just assume that they're going to get captured in some association email or a listserv that could go to somebody new or change? So how are you going to make sure that as you do these engagement areas, our small communities, our rural communities, the ones that are not in the metro, do not get missed, and there's a personal outreach if we start to see a gap in involvement? Mm-hmm. And then I have a second question.
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, I'm not certain how the invite lists are created. We have existing roundtables that for providers and managed care organizations and people, recipients that use the program. So I imagine that we're using some of those same distribution lists. And potentially, I think people can sign up to get emails about them. But I will follow up and confirm that and let you know. And I think your point about how are we monitoring where there's gaps, and it's maybe not just taking a proactive approach to reach out to them and invite them to the meeting, but if, to your point, if they're busy and they're not able to make every roundtable, if they've got, you know, patient meetings during that time or whatnot, that we find other ways for them to get the same information. I know we do send emails after those roundtables providing updates, but I think, you know, I don't know if we record those, if people can access them on their own time, for example, but that's something that I will take back to our team. Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you. And I do think it's important to track, because I think it will tell a really good story at times too, that if there's areas, regional areas, that we start to see fraud, and then we can pair that with the lack of involvement or understanding of the process, it may fall back on you on your lack of education and outreach to communities too. The next question I have is, from an IT system standpoint, we've been talking a lot in the last 6 years about updating IT systems. I mean, it's like SSIS, you name it. Like, we know some are like as old as Oregon Trail, seriously. And so I worry a lot about what we're trying to do here. And I hate outsourcing to other organizations. Like, we've seen there's a lot of fraud there as well. And so where are we in the ability to actually implement an IT system that's under us and our standards, that we're not outsourcing to other people to do our work? Are we there? Do we have the funding? Do we have the IT system?
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, in short, no, we're not there. We don't have what we need, and we need to do more work on it. I think the department would be really interested. Governor's budget recommendations aren't decided yet, but would be happy to work with you, because we do have some ideas around what's needed in terms of our data upgrades, IT upgrades. They are quite costly usually, so it will probably be a process to get there, but certainly it's something that we need to start putting into place. You know, as you know, we've got a contract right now with an external vendor, there are, you know, concerns about that, understandably, and we understand the concerns about outsourcing as well, particularly for services like this. So what we are thinking about right now is potentially our next step in using that, you know, data analytics tool, is issuing a request for information to the community, to others who do this kind of work, to better understand what resources might be available and how we could potentially build something. You know, maybe it's some of the work is happening in-house, maybe some of it is being contracted, but we really want to be more collaborative externally to try to go into the second phase of what does prepayment review, what does better data analytics look like. I would also say that related to systems, we also want to get to a place where we're using the data analytics right now, the tool, the algorithm, and we're improving it. But we're at some point building some of that logic into MMIS so that it's a little bit more automated, because I think the volume of the claims right now that we're reviewing is large. And if we were to increase that volume, I think we would probably struggle. We need to have humans involved in the process, because we need to have checks and balances. But to the extent that we can automate more in MMIS, that's also a goal of ours.
Representative Gilmer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Director Graham. So I just want to piggyback off of that IT piece, because with all the different conferences I've been to, you know, we're one of 10 states that still has the counties do the determination, different things like that. So I just want to talk about IT, not just from a DHS perspective, but has Minnesota ever collaborated with the other states that do eligibility waivers, or just have we collaborated with other states that are doing the work right now? Because every conference that I've been to, I will show them pictures of what we have to do here. And when we talk about waste and fraud and the error rate, it's nauseating. And it's actually quite sad, and it's amazing the people that do the work to determine eligibility and the things that are required, not only federally, but from our state standards to get those dollars to the people. This is something that we can do, and we need to do this. It's from the 80s, and it's crazy. But my question to you is, has DHS, have we ever done a task force? I'm guessing there's probably been task force around this work, but I don't want to just keep talking about it. It's so vital and important. And I believe we are missing the boat, and there's tons of waste happening. So I'd love to know the stats between fraud and waste. What do you see happening from DHS? Do you see more fraud, or are you seeing more waste? And then we also have to figure out how we can partner with our counties and support them and do that work and then make those investments, because I do believe we will see a great return on our investment that way. Mm-hmm. That's one question.
Chair Noor, Representative Gilman, I'm not certain if we've collaborated with other states. I would think we have. There's a technology advisory council that we're a part of, legislators are a part of. There's a lot of in-depth conversations that go way above my head on how systems work, but those are ongoing conversations and focuses in other spaces. We've also been having in-depth conversations with counties about that aspect of, eligibility. There are some programs that we've worked with the legislature to establish that we've actually have the department doing eligibility for. Typically, counties do eligibility, as you know, but in some cases, for example, the reentry waiver, mm-hmm. the department established that, knowing that that would be a challenging lift for counties, and that maybe it was a better, more efficient use of funds for us to do that eligibility. So I think those are ongoing conversations. The counties are really engaged. They're really interested. But we totally agree we need to upgrade our systems, and they can be a really important tool to make sure that we're being efficient with our resources. In terms of whether there's more waste or more fraud, I think it depends on the program. So right now we're seeing some of the 14 programs that we identified, there's a few of them where we're seeing a lot of issues where payment is being, we're making payments for services that we're finding aren't delivered. So we're seeing a lot of credible allegations of fraud in certain pockets. I will say with our prepayment review process, we've seen so far that's not fully implemented. We're starting slow and moving up to using all of the data analytics and making sure that we're training that system. But so far, we've seen more errors than fraud. And that also could be a factor of, what we've heard from our law enforcement partners is when you do institute some of these changes, it tends to have a chilling effect on bad actors and criminals that are trying to set up programs just to defraud the state. I hope that's a helpful response. Happy to follow up.
Representative Gilman.
So a follow-up I have really quick, I want to go to housing supports. So you said that Medicaid cannot pay for housing, but yet the state is paying for the housing. And, we just did some work with housing stabilization as well. So I just want to know, where does the money come from around the housing supports piece of it?
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Director Graham.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, housing supports is a state-funded program, and that pays for there's different aspects of the program. So it can pay for room and board up to a certain amount. I think every year there's a COLA on how much can be paid for an individual depending on their household size. And people have to be income eligible, providers have to be eligible to do housing support. So there are parameters around that program, but it is one of the hallmarks of Minnesota's human services systems. Not a lot of other states have it. Housing support has been used for many years in group homes, for example, in four-person group homes. Mm-hmm. And we're finding that in some other newer settings, there's some limitations that counties are expressing, so we're trying to expand that option there. So housing support can be paying room and board. There are also supplemental services that could be paid for housing support recipients that meet certain criteria that might need supports with, budgeting or, landlord, engaging with their landlord and things like that. So those are services and room and board that are provided under housing supports. And I don't know if you were referencing housing stabilization services before.
Well, yes. And then also with around recovery residences and just all of those things.
Okay.
There is the ground.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Representative. Housing Stabilization Services was a medical assistance benefit. It was a Medicaid benefit. It was established under a HCBS, a Home and Community-Based Services waiver, that paid for it, not the housing itself, but services to help people find and maintain housing. And I think there was also a part of that service that helped, that paid for an assessment to determine what the individual needed. So that was different than paying for room and board. Medicaid doesn't pay for room and board, but that is a more innovative approach that has become a new option. I think Minnesota was the first state to use that kind of waiver for those services, though other states have provided those services under different authorities. As it relates to recovery residences, the provisions that passed last session allowed recovery residences to get housing support if they are eligible, have to meet all the income and other eligibility requirements and have to have the appropriate setting in place. But they can get housing support through the state under the language that was passed last session by the legislature. So typically the county agency holds that that contract or the housing support agreement with the provider, but for recovery residences, we modified that. So because counties were feeling they didn't have the capacity in some cases to oversee those, there was a little bit of funding that the legislature provided last session so that instead those settings can work directly with the state and get the housing funding that they need so that they're in compliance.
Wonderful.
Representative Gilmer.
Okay, last thing, Chair. So I will just go back really quick to when you talked about the things that we put in place last year, how you can stop payments or, you know, hold payments for a while. So the 79th defendant was just charged, I believe, just this week in regards to the Feeding Our Future fraud case. She also had licensure and had business with a daycare. So at what point does DHS step in and go, okay, this is still under investigation or people have not been convicted? When does the stop payment or a pause on their payments, or when does a red flag go up and go, oh, we have to, does it take years? Does it take a year? Does it take months? Is it in the same week? And again, I'm going back to transparency, and I know people, there's going to be a lot of feelings around this, but because it is, I'm talking to our constituents that are working two jobs that just want to go to their kids' basketball game, and they're seeing these things, and they're just, we should all be infuriated by that. And again, I said it when we did our working group with the Senate, we did really good work, we did hard things, but I did point to those fraudsters, and the people that are going to suffer are people that actually need these services. And it's, we're seeing it, and we're going to keep seeing news stories. We're going to, and I want to hear the stories. But it goes back to, we have a system that is broken, potentially, and some things that are working really well. But I want to know the timeline, because it's sometimes people that, you know, own businesses or run a house, have a bunch of kids, and somebody went and stole cookies out of the cookie jar. I would literally have my kid open their mouth, and I can tell you ate the Oreos. Like, I mean, so I just, there's things that are happening that we just want to know, what is that timeline? Can you come to us if we need to even tighten it up more so there's more authority so things can be stopped like that?
Director Graham, I know childcare is within DCYF, but I think other related services, we have done some few things to make sure that there's a robust process, if you can explain.
Chair Noor, Representative Gilman, you're right. We need to be very tight when we identify providers that potentially are fraudulent. I would say imposing a payment withhold can happen pretty quickly. I don't have specific data with me, but typically it could happen within a couple of weeks. We have to establish that something is a credible allegation of fraud in order to do a monetary, you know, a payment withhold or a payment suspension, I believe it's called in statute. That definition is outlined in law. So there are some requirements, appropriately so, because we don't want to, as a system, just be, you know, imposing payment withholds when we don't have a specific process and criteria in place to be able to do that. But that's defined in law. And our process at DHS is typically, you know, we're getting a referral or we're identifying an anomaly through our systems work that we're doing. We also have contractors that we work with that are required through CMS that sometimes give us referrals around anomalies they might see. And then there's staff in the program integrity office that are looking, investigators that are looking, digging into that. They say, okay, it meets the standards of credible allegation of fraud. I'm going to move this up to my supervisor. Their supervisor looks at it. Then the attorney that oversees the area looks at it to make sure, are we meeting all the requirements in law? From there, it goes, I think, up to the inspector general to make the final sign off. So there is a process by which we want to be really sure that what we're seeing, what the documentation we have, does align with what a credible allegation of fraud is. And so that's really the time, what's happening in that time, but usually it's within a few weeks. I'm not intimately involved or aware of what happened with some of the Feeding Our Future collaboration with other state agencies and how that worked, but I do know that the agency has been reviewing all of that information, the information that we've received around defendants and making sure that we're looking at all of our grantees and all of our programs to identify where there's potentially someone who could be engaged in that behavior.
And to that effect, I think we passed legislation saying if there's any charges in federal or state or any other program, that the agencies will take appropriate action immediately. So I think that is in this statute. We have Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Director Graham, thanks for being here. First, the area I wanted to ask a question on, and I don't know if you can remember when you made the comment, you were talking earlier about counties struggling with case management in terms of communication. Can you explain a little bit more what they're struggling with on that? Is it because their case managers are not getting information, getting out? Is it because of the interface with IT? Is it rates? What is happening in that area? If you could explain that a little bit more, please.
Sure.
There, the ground.
Chair Noor, Representative Fisher, probably good to talk with the counties too, but what we've heard, we have pretty close relationships with them, is that waiver case managers in particular have extremely high caseloads.
Yep.
And they're unmanageable. And for those that might have, you know, in this room or watching online, if you know what case management is, it is an intensive service. It's a really critical service to the entire home and community-based services system. In fact, in large part, I can't emphasize how critical of a service waiver case management and just case management in general is. And when we're seeing, you know, county case managers with 50, 60 person caseloads or more, that's just not sustainable. And that's not really case management, that's transactional services, right? So I think that's what we've heard about. I know legislators have been involved in this issue for a while and we've been talking with counties. That's what we're hearing, is that there's just a lot of resource limitations. The rate for waiver case management is quite low and it hasn't been changed for I don't know how many years, a very long time. So that's definitely a factor and something that we would like to work with the legislature on, because I think we are really seeing the system is, you know, identifying and getting better at identifying program integrity issues. Case management is actually a key part of how we deliver strong services with integrity. So we really should be looking at the reimbursement to better support counties in that way. I mean, counties are also experiencing workforce shortages like we all are. I was just talking with Representative Hicks a little bit about some of the struggles I'm having hiring, and I'm sure all of us in our various careers outside of the legislature here are encountering those struggles with just a workforce shortage, a shortage of people. So certainly that's part of it. But that's my understanding, Chair Fisher, and I'm, you know, happy to work with the counties more and get you a better understanding of where there might be some gaps. I also mentioned that just in general, I think even when a case manager knows an eviction might be imminent, potentially an illegal eviction in some of these cases, they're struggling to find housing. There isn't the housing that we need in the community as well. So there's so many complicating factors to this work that are really brought to light that hopefully we can make some movement on this session.
Chair Fisher.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Noor, and thank you, Director Grama. You know, I've been hearing some of the same things as you were mentioning in terms of the high caseloads. Part of it is the reimbursement rate coming in. And I do know that's an issue because, as you've pointed out, these are the first people that are going to see some of the problems out there that can start reporting it. But if they're overloaded and struggling to take care of the clients there, they're not going to notice some of the things out there. So it's one of the things I know that we need to address, and I will be continuing. I do have something coming forward later on this session on it. And I also want to make sure that we also take a look as to, you know, how do we determine what's on, you know, high caseloads, et cetera. We need to do more work in that area. And so I'll be looking forward to doing that with you. The other part I want to pivot to is you were mentioned before that, you know, we've had a lot of cases where fraud is being prosecuted, et cetera. When there are recoveries, what happens to the dollars on it? Because I know we've got federal dollars coming in, we've got state dollars coming. So when a recovery happens, where do those dollars go? Do they go to us? Do they go to the federal government? Is it a share? How does that all work?
Director Grau.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, this is the moment when I wish Ms. Bailey wasn't over in the Senate Health and Human Services Committee competing with the time this committee holds. But my general understanding is that when there are monetary recoveries, that they are split. Some of it does go to the federal government and some of it comes back to DHS or the state, I believe. I don't think it comes right. I think it drops to the bottom line. So I don't know that we get to and Mr. Berg is nodding his head and can probably be my phone a friend on this issue. But I think it's a good point because we do have money coming back, and we've seen that in the past year, and that's great to see. Of course, we would like to maximize those settlements and what we're getting back as a result of the fraudulent actors that have been in the system. But hopefully we can do more prevention and prevent that altogether.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, members, Ms. Grom is right. If there's a recovery and there is a federal share in the service from which the recovery was attached, then the feds get their percentage share out of the recovery. The rest of it, the state share, drops to the bottom line of whichever fund it came from. So typically the general fund, although it could be another fund.
Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Director Grom. I want to just start with, as we continue this conversation throughout session, I'm just sitting here feeling so mad and frustrated that folks have put us in the position, folks have robbed vulnerable people of the resources that they need to survive. And it just pains me that we are focused on this conversation because of bad actors, and we could be making progress in Minnesota, and instead we're dealing with the fallout of people who decided to cheat taxpayers. There are so many good things that we could be doing in this committee and others, and I just, as I'm sitting here and we're having this conversation and across the aisle, we are agreeing on nearly every single point. This is maddening and frustrating. This isn't directed at you, Director Grom. But I just want to say that as part of this conversation and just be absolutely clear that while we're talking about these details, I wish we didn't have to. I wish that people were not so disgusting that they misused these funds in this way. It's just reprehensible, and I just have to say that on record. I can't imagine being a person who is so low and so foul that they would rob vulnerable people of the things that they need. And when we talk about the measures that OIG, the administration, DHS has taken, some of those prevention efforts have included cutting funding off before ensuring people have the home and supports that they need. To your point, Director Grom, there isn't the housing need that we have, right? And so we can talk about continuity of care. We sat in an in-person meeting with OIG Clark, and I asked about what the continuity of care looked like. And he, you know, presented it as an opportunity for a case manager to work with their service recipient to find a new place to live. Mm-hmm. That's a really nice way of saying, that's not my problem, the county's gonna figure it out. And when we asked, do you have a list of places where these folks might be able to go? Where are the openings that you expect? Give us some names, because we know this is a challenge. You must have an idea where people might go. Nothing. Because there is a housing shortage, and there aren't places for people to go. So as we're learning about the systems that have been put in place, I just want our members and the public to understand that some of the information missing here is that we can't just keep talking about how the funds meant to help vulnerable people are being stolen and then be okay with those same people being collateral damage in this conversation. At some point, we have to make a stand and say that even though this fraudulent behavior is despicable, we will not let vulnerable people fall through the cracks on our watch. Mm-hmm. And that is the part that I struggle with in this conversation, is that I wish we didn't have this fraud to deal with in the first place, because it's wrong for so many obvious reasons. But then when we try to tackle it, what ultimately ends up happening is that we aren't serving the people that we are elected to serve. That does fall back on us, even though it's the people committing fraud, they're the root of the problem, right? They are to blame. But we need to have systems in place that make sure that people aren't going homeless, that people aren't being displaced without a place to go, that they have continuity of care. That continuity of care that has been talked about is not being implemented. It's not being implemented because we don't have the resources. And so we keep doing these actions where we're putting the cart before the horse, and yes, we want to make sure that fraudulent providers are stopped, that funds are supposed to go where they need to go, but not at the expense of the person at the end of that dollar. And I know that's a hard choice to make, and I know that politically that is a very difficult thing to say, but we are being forced to make some of these choices. And I'm not saying we shouldn't go after fraud. That is the opposite of what I'm saying. I'm saying we need to do better at looking forward at the possible outcomes for the people that we are responsible for. And what I've seen through this process is that it's been hastily driven. We're not getting answers on who in particular is making decisions around the actions that are happening at DHS. We're not even sure who decided Optum got the contract. We know a list of people who decided they didn't want to look at it and just never changed the language. But we don't know who's making the decisions. We ask and we're not told. So to Representative Murphy's point, I have the same questions. How long have we known about some of these things? Who knew about it? What position does that person hold? And why haven't we fired anybody? Why haven't we? Why? This has been a crisis, a long ongoing crisis. And I think at this point, Minnesotans are very well aware that we're in a deep hole that has been dug. And we know that it's going to take time and very careful, a thoughtful process to get us through this while keeping people safe. At the bare minimum, I think what Minnesotans are just asking for is a little bit of acknowledgement of accountability on the state's part in all of this. Yes, the fraudsters are the people who are responsible, and the state is responsible to handle it with accountability and responsibility and with compassion for the people that we serve. So I think my sort of ask in general as we move forward in this conversation about fraud with regard to people who are vulnerable, I would love to see the state agencies, I would love to see the administration stop the efforts to try to save face in all of this and just own up to what's been done that was hastily decided, that hasn't been done right. This isn't on you, Director Grom. This is something I expect from a commissioner or a governor even, and haven't gotten yet, is an apology, is an I'm sorry. You were right, community members. You were right, legislators. We didn't know what we're doing, and we messed up. That's all we need to hear. And that would make so many people feel even a little bit better that the state takes this problem seriously. And it's really difficult when you're a legislator trying to push this message and trying to do the things and try to change the laws. But the people who have been responsible for the work that has been done refuse to take accountability and apologize. And that then falls on the rest of us on both sides. And that's not fair. So I just, you know, in general, as we continue this conversation, we have to continue to focus on the people who have lost their services. I don't know that we have gotten clear numbers. We asked in person, how many letters did you send out on a particular topic? Oh, we don't know that. How do you print a number of letters and you don't know how many? How do you have a list of people and you can't count with your fingers and tell us how many letters you sent? These are the kind of like little pieces of information that we're just not getting that is not only causing mistrust between Minnesotans and all of us, regardless of party, but it's causing mistrust between legislators and the agencies we're supposed to be partnering with. And so this is, it's frustrating on so, so many levels, but I just have to say that moving forward, what's desperately needed in this conversation and has been missing the entire time is a message from our administration and the top of DHS that they are sorry for their role and what has gone wrong. I know I feel sorry for my role and anything that I could have done to prevent it. We passed the laws that we could, but people still took advantage of us. So we're going to pass more laws so that they can't do that. We're doing what we need to do. Just a little bit of acknowledgement, compassion, accountability. Sometimes that just looks like, you're right, we messed up, and here's how we're going to fix it, and an invitation to let people in to help fix the problem. Thank you.
Representative Vine.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions. So, as you can see, we're all kind of passionate, so I'll try to keep them tight here. Director Grom, do you have a project management team with an overall vision? Oh, sorry, I should start off. IT modernization, right? Like it's Representative Gilman and I, ooh, talking my love language. So do you have a project management team with an overall vision with, you know, say technical work groups, the business team that I think includes counties in this conversation, project timelines, deliverables, and maybe a long-term maintenance plan for the IT systems at this point?
Director Grum.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we do have a variety of work groups that are occurring with counties specifically. I don't know all of the details about all of the plans, but we do have a business solutions office and multiple entities. I mentioned the Technology Advisory Council that are working on IT modernization. Certainly we have, there's I think things on our website too about what some of the long-term visions and plans are for the spending, for the funding that we've received. But happy to follow up if you've got concerns or if you've got specific, funding pieces like, you know, Maxis or SSIS that you want more information on specifically.
Yeah.
Representative Barney.
Yes, I would like to follow up with that. So thank you. I have had the opportunity to tour a lot of providers in my community who've been impacted by the prepayment withholds, or prepayment review and payment withholds. And so I'm curious, because this is a question that has come from providers, how many have been investigated to the point where the credible allegation of fraud that triggered the withhold has been substantiated or not? And what have been those results?
So I think that's a question that we're going to be asking the OIG clerk.
OIG, okay. I can
So
wait.
Those are things I think we're pending. Many All things right. that are going to be happening around here. So any other follow-up? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Kern, for those comments. I think, you know, we're thinking a lot alike. You know, when it comes to, trying to find out who knew what and when they knew it, I don't want to know what the CEO has to say. I don't want to know what the commissioner has to say. The people that stepped forward weren't the commissioners. weren't the directors. The hundreds of people that stepped forward are whistleblowers, probably at all different levels. We need to hear from everybody. That's what we get. That's the verification we missed out last time. If we just get the information from the commissioner, we're good with whatever they tell us, I guess. But that's not what people are saying at all different levels. So my question still stands. I think it's important for anybody that comes to us as a messenger to be able to talk about what they knew and when they knew it with regard to fraud and with regard to whistleblowers, and if they know of anybody that's been fired. I think that's a fair question to ask here. That's what our job is to do. We're trying to build this relationship between agencies and the government and the people, and the people are torqued because nobody's asking these questions. And so I'd like to know the answers to those questions because she is the director of government affairs in the DHS. I'd love to know your thoughts on what you saw, when you saw it, what it was and when did you see it with fraud and whistleblowers, and if you knew of anybody that's been fired.
I think you're absolutely right. I think we talked and discussed about if there's any whistleblower, we have good options that they have. They can report it to the law enforcement. They can report it to us. They can go to the Office of Legislative Auditor because that's a place we want to be able to collect the data and get independent body to inform us what has been happening. And yes, there are people who have connected with all the above. And I think we discussed it directly when we set the parameters in protecting whistleblowers last session to ensure that that system is there. Anybody with any information that will help us end this chaos of anybody committing fraud against children with autism, against seniors, against people with disabilities. I cannot even speak because I'm frustrated with that. We are all frustrated with that. We can't take this anymore. Because it's a stealing for those who are most vulnerable Minnesotans, who are being neglected at the same time. They need to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, and that's why we'll be discussing ways to make sure that they're held accountable. As we'll be hearing about the MFUCU, the Medicaid Fraud Unit, in explaining on the work that they've been doing, in getting more information from the Office of Legislative Auditor to come and explain to us what they've done, who they're connected with. We have got ways to get all that information before us. In fact, the commissioner is the person who's responsible for the agency. Every time we draft legislation, we empower the commissioner and say, you are responsible for the entire entity. So I hear you. We're going to get to the bottom of all this because we are frustrated. All of us are when it comes to anybody, bad actors who are committing fraud against the most vulnerable individuals. So I don't want to put Director Graham in the crosshair right now, but I assure you, as part of our discussion, that accountability is going to be happening here.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, there's one more comment on it. It's in spite of the actions of the leadership of DHS, these whistleblowers came through. The massive whistleblowers didn't show up under the regular way we do business. They've showed up in spite of it, and that's why we need to keep asking these questions. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Representative Buck, I think we've got a few minutes, so.
I'm going to be quick. So, thank you. And I would agree, first of all, we have not heard anything from the administration, but we also heard that we need to get more resources. I agree. But the taxpayers I talk to does not want to give more resources to this agency right now. We talk about fraudsters. The bad actor is DHS. They didn't do their job. If we don't do our jobs, we don't get reelected here. If I don't do my job if I don't keep accountability with my business and I take the money that I have borrowed from the bank, I'm dressed up in orange. And there's people at DHS that needs to be dressed up in orange, including folks who sent out a letter like you said. They don't know the amount of letters set up. That's lazy. That's acting like a robot. And taxpayers in my district is peed off. I've been hearing this over and over and over, this lazy fare. We're a big agency. We get to call the shots. You are our steward. And I know I'm referring to the agency. My challenge is not against you. We work well together. But you got to bring this message here to the governor, to the commissioners, and all the people who act like a robot, who didn't say, ooh, we're doing it because we have constituents in the district who don't get those monies. It's time that DHS gets their rear end in gear and be accountable for taxpayer dollars. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have the last words, Representative Franson.
I don't think I could say it any better than what Representative Backer said. People need to be held accountable, even if those people are employed by our government. That is what the taxpayers are expecting. They want to see people locked up, put in jail, and held accountable for the fraud and the waste and the abuse. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We've got a lot of work to do, and this is just the beginning. So by the end of session, we have to make sure that we're protecting the resources of the taxpayers. That's our responsibility. That's our work. And we better get started right now before it's too late. So thank you so much. We will see everyone here back again on Tuesday at 8:15 a.m. again. So thank you so much. Thank you, Director Grant. We are now adjourned.